WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Far-right nationalist candidate Marine Le Pen advanced in yesterday's French elections. Back home, U.S. officials say border wall construction will start as early as this summer. In a world that can seem to be retreating to the nation state, foreign policy expert Anne-Marie Slaughter has a new book with a grand strategy to embrace open society, government, and international relations, all while pursuing American values. Who's got it right? This hour On Point, globalization and nationalism in a networked world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Can we have fortress nations in a networked world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Paris to talk about the outcome of the French elections is Sophie Petter, Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist. Sophie, thank you very much for being with us there in Paris.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be with you again.
So how are the French interpreting the outcome of this election?
Well, it's a real upheaval. I mean, it's the most extraordinary result, certainly, that I've ever covered, and I think that the French feel they've had in recent history. You know, for the first time ever in the past 60 years, neither of the two mainstream political parties, so the Socialists on the left and the Gaullist Party on the centre-right, is in the final run. So this is just an extraordinary situation. Instead, you've got these two candidates, neither of whom represent a mainstream party. You've got Emmanuel Macron, who's only 39 years old, and then Marine Le Pen on the far right. And one of them is going to end up president. So I think we're in completely uncharted territory, really, with this election. It's, in a way, one of the most interesting things about it is that it is exactly a sort of choice between the two competing visions that you just mentioned. That's to say, a sort of the closed nationalist protectionism that is, and Euroscepticism that's on offer from Marine Le Pen, and a much more sort of market-friendly, globalizing kind of outlook, which supports, you know, the transatlantic alliance and definitely to support Europe, that's on offer from Emmanuel Macron. So we really are looking at a very stark choice and a very different choice.
Sophie, why is Emmanuel Macron seen as such an outsider? After all, he was inside the government. He was economics minister.
I know, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, one of the things that he's been so skilled at doing is kind of reinventing himself as an outsider, when actually a lot of his background is a very much sort of establishment. But I think the reason is this. I think it's because he is offering a different way of doing politics. You know, he wants to break down these old party divisions. He wants to sort of put an end to all the point scoring and the kind of gesture politics, that sense in which, you know, you have to sort of hack your way up the party in order to get anywhere in political life. And he's trying to say, let's bring in other people. Let's make the National Assembly more representative. Let's bring in a different way, a more constructive way of doing politics. I mean, it sometimes sounds a bit too good to be true. And we'll see whether this actually is, whether he's able to put this in place when the French go to vote for their new parliament in June. You know, at the moment, this is just a presidential election. And even though we are very conscious that the French constitution gives the presidency a very, great powers, it is nonetheless important to have a government with you who was able to put in place some of your policies. So, you know, whether or not his new way of doing politics is actually feasible, we'll see that in June.
It's interesting. In the U.S. election, of course, last year, most Republicans rallied around Donald Trump, though he was an outsider. But here we had, here's a little sound of François Fillon after the elections, or as they were unfolding yesterday. And he's conservative. He's very conservative, not as much as Marine Le Pen, but still he's the Republican conservative here, urging his supporters to vote against her in the final. It's almost as if it would have been Republicans in some way asking their followers to vote for Hillary Clinton last year. Here was Fillon.
I assure you that extremism can only lead to misery and division in France. As a result, our only choice is to vote against her, which means in favor of Emmanuel Macron. So I will be voting for Emmanuel Macron.
Interpreted there by Bloomberg. But what do you make of that, Sophie, that you've got the conservatives saying don't go with Marine Le Pen? How does that shake out in France, in French political terms?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think the comparison is exact, because could ask the Republicans to go behind Hillary Clinton, you'd need that to be against a far-right candidate like Marine Le Pen. And that's what makes it so different here. You know, there is a tradition in France of calling for a sort of united front against the far right. And this has happened in regional elections in December 2015. There were some very crucial regional elections in France at which National Front was in the second round in two key regions. And what happened was actually the socialist candidate withdrew, leaving it to be a runoff, which was the only way of beating the far right candidate. So there is a tradition of sort of stepping down or backing the alternative. And I think that's what you're going to be looking at in the second round more generally when voters decide whether or not to vote for Macron. It's not that he has majority support in this country. We've seen that in the election in the first round. He doesn't. He's got less than a quarter of voters behind him. But there will be voters who will vote for him because they don't want her to get into power.
And is there any kind of projection at this point about how that final race is shaping up? Does it appear to be close? Do we have any idea at this point?
Yes, it's not looking close. It's looking like it's going to be fairly clear victory for Emmanuel Macron, the centrist independent. First time he's run for election for any office. You need to remember that. It's quite an amazing story. Not even a local council, you know. So most polls, in fact, every single poll has shown that he would beat Marine Le Pen by quite a comfortable majority, something that could even go to sort of 60% against 40% for her. So I think it's incredibly difficult for Marine Le Pen to get the 50% she'd need in the French system. It's a very simple, direct universal suffrage. You just need to get over that 50% barrier. And I think it's very hard for her having to make up the lost ground. So I think we are looking in all probability at a President Macron.
And finally, Sophie, if it should be Macron in the end and not Marine Le Pen, does that look to you like a high watermark for populist nationalism in Europe, or maybe not?
Well, I just think it's sort of tempting to look at it that way, but then what you need to do is look at the number of people who voted for Marine Le Pen at this first round compared to 2012, the last French presidential election. She's added more than 1 million voters.
Yeah.
You know, this is someone who is progressing nonetheless. There will be, I'm sure, a temptation to sort of say she's somehow failed or disappointed if she doesn't win the presidency. But I think that would be a mistake because, you know, there is an anger out there. We've seen it in the UK. We've seen it in the US. There is an anger against, the establishment, against the system. And I think that, you know, Emmanuel Macron, if he does become president, he will be under incredible pressure to actually then deliver. Because if he doesn't, then you are looking at a much tighter race, even tighter still, in 2022.
Sophie Petter, Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist. You can hear her in Paris right there. Sophie, thank you very much for being with us. If you want a sense of what the French have been hearing in France here after advancing to the second round in the French elections, Marine Le Pen delivered a victory speech to her supporters in France's northern Rust Belt yesterday. And here she's decrying the rise in globalization, interpreted by Bloomberg.
Either we gone towards globalization without borders, the consequence being relocations abroad, mass immigration, the free movement of terrorists, the reign of money, or you choose a France where we have borders to protect our jobs, our power, living standards, our national identity.
No to globalization, therefore Marine Le Pen. But the favorite now, Emmanuel Macron, different message, centrist candidate, his victory speech in Paris yesterday. He refused to call her by name, but he warned of the dangers of nationalism. Here he is in a clip interpreted by C-SPAN.
And I wish 2 weeks from now to become your president.
Le président de tout le peuple de France.
The president of all the peoples of France. The president of the patriots. Confronted with the threat of nationalism.
Patriots confronted with the threat of nationalism. How interesting this is. Anne-Marie Slaughter joins us right now from Princeton, New Jersey. She was director of policy planning at the U.S. State Department for a couple of years, 2009 to 2011. That is very high in the U.S. foreign policy establishment, certainly at that time. She was dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. She's currently president and CEO of New America Think Tank in Washington and author of the new book, The Chessboard and the Web, Strategies of Connection in a Networked World. Anne-Marie Slaughter, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here today.
Tom, it's great to be back.
What do you make of the French election outcome?
I think it's a very good outcome. Most important, you have a candidate who will now rally the center-left and the center-right together against the far-right and against Le Pen. That's a very good result. You just heard really all the polls are very strongly for Macron now, 60-40. It's not like either Trump or Brexit where the polls were within the margin of error. But equally important, I think, is that the two established parties were upended. This is an effort to build a new kind of politics, and that is something I think we're actually seeing in all three countries. In Britain, Labour has collapsed. In the United States, Donald Trump was hardly a regular Republican, and Bernie was certainly no regular Democrat. And so this we've seen a lot of economic upheaval and obviously technological upheaval, and now comes political upheaval.
If it's Macron in France, if France rejects Marine Le Pen in the final election, do you see this as a peeking out of the anti-globalist movement or not?
No. I think as Sophie pointed out, you have a million additional voters for Le Pen. That's true in any of these countries, in the Netherlands as well. The center held, but Geert Wilders is still very much there and gaining support. This is probably a decade-long struggle between exactly people who want to put up walls and close off their countries and those who want to stay open to the world.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about globalization, nationalism, and what comes next in a networked world where people are now talking about walls and fences. My guest is Anne-Marie Slaughter. She's been right in the top tier of American foreign policy making, was there in 2009 to 2011 as Director of Policy Planning in the U.S. State Department at the elbow of Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State. She's been dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. She's author of the new book, The Chessboard and the Web, Strategies of Connection in a Networked World. And we will certainly look at that. The book comes out at a time when globalism and nationalism are having a real run for it. In the inaugural address of the new president of the United States, it was very clear it was nationalism first, America first. Here was Donald Trump.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
And now there may be soon sort of teeth put to that. We're not talking about, Anne-Marie Slaughter's talking about networking. Here is Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly. An interview last week with Fox News, not talking about networking, talking about walls, the wall, the border wall between the United States and Mexico, saying construction will start soon.
I think by late spring, early summer, we'll have some prototypes, and then we'll be able to move forward by into the summer. So we won't be able to do it all in one afternoon, that is, build a wall and physical barrier, see-through wall, depending on the conditions. But we're going to get at it as quick as we can.
She's talking networking. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions yesterday on ABC News This Week talking that wall. We need that wall.
We need that wall. It'll help us complete the promise that the president has made to the American people. That's what they want. The American people have a right to expect it. And I believe Congress will eventually deliver.
Anne-Marie Slaughter, why have we come to this point where you've got, for a long time, it seemed like globalization was destiny. It was fate for the world. It was just simply going to happen. Now you've got significant pushback, regardless of what happens in France. What's brought us to this point?
Well, the globalization that's happened has been extremely rapid, and so rapid that many people have had their lives disrupted. They lost their jobs. That's in part due to automation as well as globalization. But the globalization encourages automation because profit margins get very thin and people start to automate so fast that entire communities have been wiped out and people have lost their jobs, their roles in families. And that inevitably creates a sense of dislocation, lack of control, and then anger. And so it's not uncommon to have this kind of backlash. And some of it's justified. In some cases, we really do need to slow down the processes of globalization to take care of our citizens, while at the same time recognizing that when the United States is 350 million people in a world of 7 to 9 billion, we have to be open to the world.
What about Marine Le Pen's critique? I mean, we heard it earlier. We heard the tape of her. And she's saying, look, it's a choice here. And if you go with globalization, French people, you know, which she calls no borders or without borders, she said you're going to get relocation. I guess she means industry in part there. You're going to get mass immigration, which she doesn't like. She wants to stop. You're going to get, she says, the free movement of terrorists, the reign of money, money above all, you know, reduced living standards and a lost national identity. What do you make of that critique?
Well, she and President Trump, for that matter, and as well as the Brexit supporters in Britain, are basing their campaigns on gross exaggeration and indeed in some cases just outright lies. But there's a huge difference between mass immigration and open borders, which none of these countries have. And indeed, the United States has dramatically tightened border enforcement over for 20 years now and controlled immigration, where in fact, at least in the United States, we get a steady flow of some of our most talented citizens. We wouldn't be a country without that. It is also true that if you have too much immigration too fast, you can have this sense that national identity itself is being lost. I do think it's the role of government, again, to slow things up, to make sure that immigrants are integrated, which is as important for them as it is for the surrounding society, and to maintain a narrative that says, no, the United States and France and Britain and Germany, we are different countries. We have different traditions, different languages, different cultures. And there are many good things about that. We don't want just one global hybrid culture.
So how do we get here? The critique from the right, far right certainly is that elites were asleep at the switch or more were so invested in globalization, which they were doing pretty well by, that they didn't care if it was making Rust Belt problems in the U.S. or in France. How do we get here?
I think there is something in that critique in the sense that the people in charge of trade policy and other policy benefit much more from globalization than many other citizens. But to be fair, Bill Clinton used to say routinely, our job is to make sure that the good parts of globalization outweigh the bad parts. And people in this country, for instance, have tried with retraining and other programs to help workers who've been displaced. Those programs haven't worked. And I do think we need to be much more attentive to ensuring that globalization works for all Americans or all French. And that is going to probably require slowing things up and probably some big changes in domestic economic policy.
So now here we come to this situation which your book really highlights just by its existence, which is here we are at a time when nationalists have a big megaphone. They're getting a lot of support. Macron may well win the final in France. But look, there's Marine Le Pen in the final at the same time as the world has never been more networked. We've got networks and walls going up at the same time. How does that play out, Anne-Marie Slaughter? How does that work?
Well, there in some ways the walls are an effort to disrupt the networks.
Yes.
In that
stop,
many people
enough.
Yes, and many people I think see globalization as the project of elite networks, the folks who live in what I call airport world, and I'm often one of them, who are all connected to each other around the world. We're more connected to each other in London and Paris and Beijing and Jakarta and wherever you might be than we are to the people in our own, the rural communities or small cities in the hinterlands in our own countries. But what I was describing is actually their corporate networks, their civic networks, there are government networks, and certainly criminal networks. I don't actually think in an age of instant communications and information technology that you can stop those networks. What you can do is open them up, make them much more transparent, make them more participatory. You actually, instead of closing things off, we need to be connecting many people who feel left out or left behind to those networks.
So take us to your central metaphor, chessboard and web. Web we get as network, I guess. Chessboard?
So this is a book initially written as a foreign policy person, as I am, and I was writing about how do you see the world when you pick up the newspaper every morning and you read about international crises from North Korea to Syria to Russia to global warming, what do you think? And most foreign policy people they really have Henry Kissinger's view of the world. It's the chessboard view of the world. It's a number of great powers who play strategic games with each other to increase their power. So we do something and then we anticipate what Russia or China or North Korea is going to do in response and we try to anticipate that. And it's a chessboard. That world is very much there. I mean, don't make any mistake. It's there. But my point was the web world, that world of all those individuals and businesses and criminals and universities and civic groups, that world is also there. And we need to be able to see both at the same time.
Walls and webs going on at the same time. Anne-Marie Slaughter goes deep on how that works out. We've got a lot of callers for you, Anne-Marie, if I may go. Richard in Tampa, Florida. Richard, you're on the air with Anne-Marie Slaughter.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My personal perspective over the years, I'm a 69-year-old man. I believe that globalization is the only way to go. I do not have much to do with nationalism because I think the past has taught us the evils of it. People are people. They speak with a different tongue. And as long as government is doing its job in making sure that the right people are coming in, and that they're not allowed to collect in one particular spot like England, where cities have been taken over by people with a different approach to life, language, or whatever, are seen to, well, it causes people, English people, to believe they can't go to certain parts of their country without running into problems. I do feel that it is the way to go. Nothing stays the same.
What about the losers in globalization, Richard? And the fact that they, you know, look at your native England, look at the U.S. There are stretches that are really in trouble in this globalized era.
Well, they are the ones that need to be taken care of, Tom. And my fear is, with conservatism going off to the right as it has both in the U.K. and here, that the very weak, meaning those are not able to defend themselves, i.e. because of their lack of ability to earn a decent wage and not being supported by government with a minimum wage, then you're going to get extremes because it comes down to survival. And if you get a person with Trump, who obviously doesn't inspire me, not one iota, then they are attracted to him because they believe with what's coming out of his mouth is the truth, and he will take care of them. Of course, there's nothing further from the truth.
Take care of those who don't win in the globalized system, and maybe we're on the track. Let me hold that thought, Richard. And Anne-Marie, let me get one more, if I may. Mike in Ridgeland, South Carolina. Richard, thanks for your call. Mike, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I didn't think that globalization was such a bad thing, but there can be too much of it, such as the areas of no-go zones in Sweden. It's up to the government to make sure that who they're letting in is who needs to be in and not the criminals. A lot of people think just because Trump wants to better the people who come in, that it's a bad thing, that he's being racist and so on and so forth. It's not a bad thing. And these countries such as Sweden, Netherlands, and Belgium are overwhelmed with the Obama era of let everybody come no matter who they are. Because they are in a bad situation, it's not let everybody come, but pick and, you just almost need to pick and choose who does come. Thank you very much.
Mike, I appreciate your call very much. I mean, I should say, having spent some time in Sweden not long ago and some of the other countries you've described, yes, they have more diverse populations than they used to. I can't say that to my eye they looked overwhelmed. But Anne-Marie, right there, you've got, you know, our Tampa caller saying he's for globalization. But wait a minute, watch out for the places where the local culture begins to be endangered.
And you've got our caller in the Carolinas saying, hey, you know, basically walls can make – fences make good neighbors.
So thanks to both the callers for your calls, and you both touch on very important issues. The first point I think is exactly what I talked about, more gradual globalization, that there really isn't a choice. Again, in the world we're in, with the technology we're in, if you look at the course of human history, it's been a course of gradually but steadily increasing connection from villages to cities in individual countries, and then across borders, in with trade, with migration. That is really what unlocks a huge amount of growth and talent and creativity. But it is important to make sure that it doesn't overwhelm countries in ways that create big classes of losers. And that is where I think it's important to slow things up, to look at our trade policy. With respect to our immigration policy, with the second caller, we actually have done a lot of the things he's talking about. I mean, we now have more Mexicans leaving the United States than coming in. The peak of immigration from Mexico was the early 1990s, and it has been dramatically slowed. And as I said, now they're more actually leaving. We also do have remarkable vetting of immigrants and refugees. So when President Trump says a lot of those things, I think a lot of them President Obama agreed and put in place, President George W. Bush did. We really need a sort of common agreed set of facts there. But I do agree with both callers that, again, there's nothing wrong with national culture. I don't hold with nationalism in the sense of we're better than anybody else, and ultimately nationalism in Europe led to war. But I do believe in patriotism and the idea that we have a distinct culture, we have a distinct set of institutions, and we are entitled to treat our citizens or to serve our citizens first.
And it's interesting, of course, in France, that's exactly the way the rhetoric is kind of breaking down. Marine Le Pen talking nationalism and Emmanuel Macron talking patriotism. If you're for a more gradual globalization than we've had, do you see Donald Trump delivering that? He's tapping the brakes at the very least.
Well, it's very hard to know because we were listening to his inaugural address, which was very nationalist, very America first. But in fact, you are seeing lots and lots of changes with respect to a trade war with China. He's giving no signs that that's actually something he's going to engage in, or even with respect to changes on NAFTA or regarding our alliances. He now says NATO is no longer obsolete. It's actually very important. On Syria, he had missile strikes to uphold the Chemical Weapons Convention. So I think what he says and what he does are really quite different, and it's very hard to know what his actual policies are.
If we stay in the Trump theme, you know, he talks in a nationalistic line. Can you talk that way and be globalist at the same time?
We'll have to see. I think one of the reasons he's raising the wall again this week is because many of his supporters are worried. And indeed, many people, Ann Coulter, Laura Ingraham, people are accusing him of really betraying his campaign promises. And so he has raised again this week one of the central ones. The most visible sign of closing ourselves off is a wall.
This On Point podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Try it for free today at ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about globalization, nationalism, and what comes next in a networked world where people are now talking about fences and walls. My guest this hour is Anne-Marie Slaughter. She was director of policy planning at the State Department from 2009 to 11 under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She was dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. She's out with a new book looking at the way statecraft and international relations beyond statecraft are changing. It's called The Chessboard and the Web. We're moving, not leaving anything behind, but moving more heavily into the web side of that equation. I've already moved a long way, ironically, in a time when the fortress nation, at least the rhetoric of it, has made a big comeback. Marine Le Pen in the finals in France, Donald Trump with his America First message in the USA. Anne-Marie Slaughter, take us into some of the more nuance of how you see the power of networks working. You say the chessboard's still there. The great game or games are still on. States will still have their competitions. And that is sometimes quite necessary, you say. But the networks are rising in their power and influence. Like how?
Let's take climate change as an example, which on the one hand has chessboard elements. When that we got the Paris Agreement concluded, you had the nations of the world there to sign an agreement.
Yep.
But equally importantly, you had 7,000 cities who were have been brought together by Mayor Bloomberg in a global covenant of mayors, all committing their cities to reduce emissions. And you have thousands of non-governmental organizations thousands of corporations who are all part of global networks and all necessary to make the change that we need to essentially save our planet, such that even when Donald Trump says we are not going to honor the commitments the United States made at the federal government level, the mayors of our cities and our corporations can still have an enormous and critically important impact on carbon levels because they are tied together in problem-solving networks.
I can imagine people listening to that and say, well, I sort of get it, but, you know, the EPA is in Washington and standards are set in Washington. Federal policy in this country is set in Washington, and if you don't have that those reins of power, you know, all the mayors in the world are going to have trouble. They can't set their own national standards for emissions, let's say.
Well, California can. So at the state level, in fact, it's California's emissions controls that had the maximum effect on car makers because California is such a big market. So some standards are set at the state level, but mayors can also do things like impose charges on driving zones, as London has, or make it much harder in various ways, as Mayor Bloomberg did in New York, to drive so that people choose mass transit, and they can also, with the support of their citizens, take a number of measures, not setting emission standards, but that will actually reduce their emissions as cities. And so the EPA is in Washington, but I would say New York. And again, Mayor Bloomberg's philanthropies have played an enormous role here, have had just as much impact on solving a global problem. And I contrast statecraft with webcraft.
I mean, but on the other hand, we don't have unlimited time here. You had Bill McKibben writing over the weekend that, look, at the critical juncture, federal policy is moving away from addressing this and the ramifications of that hitting already. And there's no question. I mean, here just this month, here was the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt talking with Fox and Friends saying that the U.S. ought to reevaluate its commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement.
Paris is something that we need to really look at closely because it's something we need to exit, in my opinion. It's a bad deal for America. It was an America's second, third, or fourth kind of approach.
If it's networks versus the state, and the state is saying, no, that's some globalization rubbish that we don't want any part of, who wins?
Well, I still think citizens and cities and corporations and civic groups can win. Because, again, if you look at the Paris Agreement, it is a really innovative international agreement. It is not just states. There is room in that agreement for all these web actors. And one way you can think about it is President Trump is determined, you know, to bring back traditional fossil fuel industries. I don't think that's economic anymore, but citizens can boycott those industries. Citizens can band together, again, at the city level, at the state level, but also just with each other to reduce carbon emissions. It's a different set of tools than imposing a carbon tax or imposing emissions. But in a network world, we have a lot of those tools.
Let's go to Paula in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Paula, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
Great show. It's clear that we need some sort of a balancing act between both being open to international trade, international agreements. Those are vital. I totally agree. But just in this context, this past weekend on NPR, there was a show about AI and, you know, talking about the wonders of AI and how, you know, just think of all the drudgery jobs that will go away when we have all these great, you know, all the driving by computer. And I say to myself, okay, so what have we learned from this current situation where we haven't been able to get jobs for people who've maybe chosen a trade instead of
yep.
a college degree? And so where are we headed? We're like pushing forward with this idea of taking away more jobs without having really taken under our thoughts what the context of this is and really think more thoroughly before we just leap ahead with yet another great technology.
Paula, I appreciate your call. I mean, the politics of this are unfold over time, but they're right away when elections come around, Anne-Marie. And you saw what happened in this country last fall. You saw what happened in the UK. When people hurt, and they've hurt for a while, you know, they're going to leap for a change and have. Now, France, I don't know what's going to happen there, but you hear Paula sort of wrestling with this. The questions of tempo here. If you have maybe networks are going all kinds of directions. I wonder who the greater networker is. If it's, you know, Donald Trump looks like a pretty good networker to me. He jumped on Twitter. He got millions of people following him. And he used your network power to sort of take over the country and say, I'm going to take us in a completely different direction.
Well, Paula's question is right on the money in the sense that I think the biggest question we face as a society, and I don't think either political party has an answer, is the future of work. What are jobs? Where are the jobs going to be? And it's not enough, even if we were rich enough to provide everyone with a universal basic income, which I don't think we are. Work is the source of dignity and meaning and purpose. And, you know, a world without work does not look like a happy one, even if we had enough for people to support themselves. So that question is exactly one that unless we can answer it, you get this kind of deep insecurity and anger that then starts looking for scapegoats. And those scapegoats are often immigrants or elites, and that nurtures a very nasty kind of politics. And Tom, to your point about how you use networks, Donald Trump is a great networker as a communicator. So if you think about it, he's at the center of 26 million Twitter users, which is about half his mm-hmm. voters. That he's very effective at using that network to broadcast things. He has not been effective at actually turning that network, which is sort of him at the center and 26 million people around him, into a network that helps him govern, because those aren't people who are organized to and connected to each other. They're just all responding to him. And to actually govern and make things happen, you need a very different structured network.
So what does networked leadership look like in this century, ultimately?
Network leadership is very different than traditional top-down leadership. A top-down leadership is command and control because you have power over the people below you. Network leadership is horizontal. You're at the center of the web. So if you think about it, you're at the top of a ladder, but you're at the center of the web. And I talk about five different things that it requires. It means you have to curate who's in your network. You can't just connect everybody. You have to figure out who you need to connect. You have to connect them, and you have to connect them in particular ways, either physically or virtually, but also with different structures. You then have to cross-fertilize among them. You have to – you really have to pay people to be the network managers or the collaboration managers, where people say, did you know that this node is doing this and that node's doing that? You have to cultivate the relationships between people or among people in your network. And then finally, you have to catalyze action. So there are five C's: connecting, curating, connecting, cross-fertilizing, cultivating, and catalyzing. That's a set of skills that we rarely recognize as important job qualifications, and we don't pay for them, but we're going to have to.
Is that skill set just for the powerful? Could it – does it – has it already empowered those who did not have power?
Well, if we recognized it and paid for it, it would empower all sorts of people. For one thing, this is the work that many women have traditionally done. We've done it in our communities. We've done it in our workplaces. That's because many women never had the chance to exercise top-down power, and many of us became very adept at horizontal power. But you notice it when it's gone. When that connector is no longer there, you notice the absence. But my point is, just as we now pay for curators – that didn't used to be a job outside of an art gallery. Now it is. We need to pay for connectors and network managers, and collaboration managers, whatever title you want to use.
I'm not sure I'd pay for, like, if ordinary people want to use this networked world to be empowered, they have to hire somebody to do something? What?
No, but if you are – so just – I was giving you the example of how Mayor Bloomberg had built a coalition of mayors who are incredibly important for fighting climate change. He paid people to bring those mayors together, to tell them what each other were doing, to make sure that they were aware of how they could cooperate with each other, to catalyze action. So my point is, if you're a corporation or if you are somebody who wants to see a movement of any kind, it's not enough just to connect people and call it a network. That network will be dead unless you actually hire people to make it live, to make it work successfully. Just like a corporation, I mean, any hierarchy, you need leaders at the top. You need people at the center of networks.
We're talking about globalization and nationalism in the time of a networked world. Anne-Marie Slaughter's new book is The Chessboard and the Web. Netta in Simsbury, Connecticut. Netta, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. One of the points that I haven't heard anyone else make this morning is about the Pacific Trade Agreement, which our president kiboshed, which was one of the few things I liked about our president. When he was running, he talked about getting not accepting that agreement. We have to be really careful what we put in these global trade agreements, because this one was going to give away power that belongs to the federal government. We do not want at least I don't want corporations running this new world government. There's enough of our economy that's outside our control because we have a Federal Reserve Bank that's not part of the federal government, and most people don't even realize that. So I think if we're going to go for any kind of globalization, we really have to read all the lines of the agreement and make sure that our government is not giving away its power.
Netta, I appreciate your call. Anne-Marie Slaughter, this is an interesting case in point, the TPP. I mean, you've got a lot of people saying now, well, the U.S. has actually walked away from power in the Pacific. China will now pick that up. But you hear Netta there, it looked like a locked box to her as the deal was being done. She doesn't trust what was in there, and she's glad it's gone. You talk a lot about the importance of transparency in the time of network power.
Yes, Netta, thank you for the call. I might disagree with you about the Federal Reserve. I think it is part of the federal government. But I do agree that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, was something that many people were suspicious of, both because it was opening markets in ways that some people thought they would lose from. Many unions were opposed. And as you point out, it would have transferred power away from federal courts to arbitration panels in ways many people were uncomfortable with. On the other hand, from a foreign policy point of view, not having a Pacific trade alliance, it does weaken us as a foreign policy matter in the Pacific. And I do think part of the solution would be to open up those negotiations much more than they were so that people could see what was being negotiated. Again, I think part of the difficulties are a real divide in this country between the people who would really gain from the gains from trade and those who would not. So as a foreign policy person, I would have supported that agreement. As a domestic policy person, I certainly understood a lot of the concerns about it.
Emery, we've just got a minute here. In this networked age that we are in, how do you see the tides of nationalism and globalization now interacting in the next, you name it, decade, two?
You know, I do think this is one of the biggest issues of our time. I write at the end of the book that in the 20th century, the divide in the world was between democracies and non-democracies, and now it's between open and closed. It's between those countries who are going to control their internet and control their societies and put up walls and try to essentially isolate their countries, and those countries that are going to succeed in being open, but also succeed in taking care of their citizens. And that is a difficult balancing act. I think we veered too far toward unconditional openness. But I ultimately think, particularly as the United States of America, a country of immigrants, a country that stands for values that are universal, we have to find that balance.
Do you think we'll come back to that balancing point anytime soon in this country?
I do. But I do think I'm not sure either party can do it. I think that's why I'm so interested in the French election. Yeah. I think we may need a new movement.
We'll be watching Anne-Marie Slaughter lighting up the terrain ahead and around us right now in her new book, The Chessboard and the Web Strategies of Connection in a Networked World. Anne-Marie Slaughter, always good to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, thanks so much.
Listeners, thanks for all your calls. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.